into my PowerPoint at all about 20 minutes ago, and they've got it up, they've got it running. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. Welcome to this week. It's an honor for me to be invited to be with you. I know this is a retreat and not a conference, so I plan for my teaching to leave that so that you can leave this week feeling lighter and not heavier. Does that sound like a good idea? First thing I want to know is how many of you have an afternoon nap in your very near future? Yeah, me too. I love that. I love when I saw a blank in the middle of the day tomorrow. That was wonderful for me. So let's take a look at it. We're going to be talking in this session about redefining success in ministry. And let me begin it the way I always begin these talks, with a simple introduction of, hi, I'm Carl Vaders, and I have spent over 40 years as a small church pastor. I say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, though I spent over 40 years as a small church pastor, I didn't know I was a small church pastor for the first 25 years. I was convinced I was a big church pastor that just hadn't gotten there yet. But after 25 years of waiting to arrive, you begin to wonder did I take a wrong turn somewhere? What's going on? So we'll talk a little bit more about that. Second reason that I always want to introduce myself as a small church pastor is, most of the time in these kinds of settings, we expect that the person on the stage pastors one of, if not the biggest church in the room, and that's just simply not the case today. There's nothing wrong when that happens, but that just doesn't happen to be the case in this situation. So because of that, everything I'm going to be talking about for these 3 days that we'll have together, a lot of it will be more small church specific than you may be used to. But if you are from a big church, do not despair. There's a lot for everybody, but it will come from a small church perspective. So we'll show it this way to you in the Venn diagram. Usually in situations like this, we're kind of used to the information flowing in the direction from the big church to the small church, and it's just going to turn that arrow around, and it's going to be from a small church perspective, but for everybody. So I just want you to be aware of what that is so that you can hear where I'm coming from. Also, on this next slide, we're going to show you, I've created a landing page on my website so that all 4 sessions that I will be doing, all of the notes for them, including all of the illustrations and diagrams that I'm going to show you, are going to be on that page. So if you scan that QR code, you'll go to my link tree. The very top button will get you to that page, carlvaders.com/Spruce Lake. I tried to make it as memorable as possible for you. So if you can remember my name and where you are, there you go, carlvaders.com/Spruce Lake, and all 4 sessions will be there. One of the advantages of putting my notes online rather than in paper is about a third of the notes in there will have a clickable link that you can tap on or click on, and it will get you to an article or something else that was written about that particular topic, so you can go a little bit deeper on any of those topics if you'd like to. But before we go anywhere, let me give you a little bit of my story. So as I say, I spent 40 years in small church ministry, and I didn't know I was for the first 25 years. And at about year 25, I started getting very discouraged and very frustrated, because this was in the heat of the church growth movement, and I had pastored most of my time in pastoral ministry. The church growth movement was the predominant language that we used when pastors talked to each other. And it was all about getting bigger, and all healthy things grow, and therefore, if you're not growing, you must not be healthy. And after 25 years of the church staying small, we had some growth, but we never got past the place that everybody said you should be getting. I found myself in a very discouraged situation. Just to give you a bit of a background so you can see where I come from, our first pastorate was in a very tiny chapel in the middle of the Redwood Forest in Northern California. The redwoods, the biggest, you know, biggest trees in the world. We were so deep into the woods that if you drove into our church parking lot at noon on a sunny California day, your automatic headlights went on. There were parts of the building that literally never saw the sun. We were deep into the woods. We were there for 4 years, and they were a blessing to us, and I hope and believe that we were a blessing to them. After that, we went to a church just north of the San Francisco Bay Area. Yes, just so you know, all of my ministry experiences in California, you have to love me anyway. Jesus says so. So north of San Francisco, and we went to a church where we spent the longest 20 months of our lives. Yeah, some of you are laughing uncomfortably because you've been in similar situations. So we've been there, and we left after 20 months not sure if we were still called to ministry because we were so beaten up. We then went to a small church in Orange County, California. When we showed up, this church had been through 5 pastors in the previous 10 years. With an average of 6 to 9 months between pastors, that means they had an average stay of about 18 months per pastor. I told them, you haven't been pastored in a decade. You've had a series of extended guest speakers. And that was really kind of true. And because of that, they'd gotten very discouraged and very small. There were about 20 very discouraged seniors left. They had debated holding a vote to close the church. And they thought, let's see if the Lord has something for us. Let's bring in one more pastor. And if this doesn't work, then we're just going to shut it down. And I was that pastor, and I was coming out of a very difficult situation. So a hurting pastor came to a hurting church. I do not recommend that combination. But that's what happened to us, and the Lord used them to help heal us, and I believe the Lord used us to help heal them. It didn't happen quickly, though. Like I said, we showed up to a church with 28 people on an average Sunday morning, a very small building. If you come and sit in the back row, there will only be 4 rows in front of you. But we live on a very busy street. It's actually one of the main streets that borders Disneyland, exactly 8 miles to the north of us. Literally tens of thousands of people drive right by our front door every single day. And so I thought it won't be long until we get bigger. After all, we're about a mile from the original Calvary Chapel. Not much farther than that is the original Vineyard, Crystal Cathedral, Church on the Way, Angelus Temple, Saddleback Church. I live in a place not just where big churches happen, but where big movements have begun. And we thought, okay, we're going to apply the church growth principles, and something like that is probably going to happen to us. And guess what? It did not. But it did get healthy. In fact, I remember at year 7, after a Thursday at the office, I went out to my car, and I was about to start the car, and I was looking out the windshield at the church building, and all of a sudden it hit me. Oh, that's a healthy church. I'm looking at a healthy church. And then because I was behind the wheel of my car looking at the windshield, this image occurred to me. I thought, I feel like I've been under the hood of this car for 7 years. We finally have the engine running, and now I'm sitting behind the wheel, and I have no idea where to take it. How do you pastor a healthy church? I hadn't pastored one in a decade, and they hadn't been one in 2 decades. So I went to the board, and I said, I think we're healthy. They were more surprised than I was. But we looked around and realized we are. All we'd been doing for 7 years was worship services and meals together. Not intentionally. That's just all any of us had the capacity for was worship and food. And at that point, they said, why don't we do more than worship and food? Why don't we reach out to the community now that we're a healthy environment that we can bring people into? And we did. At that point, we were running about 75. For the next 7, 8 years or so, we started reaching out. And at about year 15, we were running about 200 people, which was more than crowding our tiny little building twice on a Sunday. That was when all the church growth conferences started calling me up and going, Carl, we want you to come and tell us how you took a church from 20 to 200 in just 15 years. Your laughter is appropriate. Yeah, not big enough, not fast enough. But we were healthy and we were getting bigger and we were running out of space. And so I couldn't find a bigger place. And so I started asking around and I found a local junior high, and they agreed to let us rent on Sundays. They agreed to let us rent what I call their Kappa Gymnatora Librarium. Did they have those in Pennsylvania too? And right around? Every junior high school in America has that all-purpose room that everybody fits in. And it was almost the size of this room from our tiny little chapel. And every Sunday we had a faithful group of people that brought all of our audio equipment, chairs, all kinds of stuff over to that. We worshiped there on Sunday morning and they brought it back and set it back up in our sanctuary because on Monday through Saturday we were still using our church building. But over the next 2 years while we were worshiping in that school building, we grew from just about 200 people to over 400 people on average on a Sunday morning. So I thought, okay, the church growth stuff is finally kicking in. This is where we're going to go. This is great. I actually went to our church board at that time and I said, we need to hire more staff because we've gone from pastoring 200 people with our tiny staff to pastoring 400 people with the same staff, and we're tired. In fact, I said, I don't want to hire a staff for a church of 400. I want to hire a staff for a church of 600 because you can see the trajectory. We're going to be there in just a year or two. They agreed, so I hired staff for a church of 600 when we were at 400. It held at 400 for a few months, And then faster than it had gone up, it started crashing. In 2 years, we went from 200 to 400. And then in less than a year, we went from 400 down to, actually, I can't tell you exactly how small we got, because it's fun to count when you're growing. But when you're collapsing, it's not so fun anymore. In fact, that was one of the things that my church growth friends were always saying. If it matters, count it. And sometimes, pastors, I got to admit, and I've run into other pastors, the same thing. It's not if it matters, count it. It's sometimes it matters too much to count. I don't know how small we got, because I told them, don't give me the numbers anymore, but I do know this. Every Sunday was under 100, and some Sundays were under 50. And there had been no scandal, and there had been no split. We did exit options, asking people, why are you leaving? They couldn't give us answers. Something just wasn't right, and they couldn't figure out what it was. And so they were leaving. We fit back into our small church again, so I fixed that problem. And after a little bit of that, I started getting angry at myself, and I guess got angry at God, and I got angry at the church. And I went to the church board and I said, I'm leaving for 40 days. And the only reason I left for 40 days was because I couldn't find an 80 in the Bible. Yeah, sad but true. I actually did a Bible word search and thought, there's got to be somebody in the Bible that I missed that took like an 80 or 100-day retreat. Because I thought, if it's in the Bible, they'll give it to me. You know, it's but it's all 40s, just so you know. So I left for 40 days. And I did not know if I would come back to the church or come back to ministry again. Spoiler alert, I did. But during that 40 days away, I spent my time... I wish I could tell you that I spent my time in prayer and fasting, but I didn't. I was too mad at God to talk to him. And I spent my time eating too much ice cream and watching too much stupid TV. And, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But also during that time, I went to a counselor nearby. He had been a pastor for himself for 20 years, and I sat in his office and I just offloaded on him. And after about the second or third session, I said, what am I supposed to do here? And he said, Carl, sounds to me like you have to figure out how to redefine success in ministry. I said, what do you mean by redefine success in ministry? And then he said this sentence, and it's a sentence that changed my life. He said, Carl, you have to figure out how to define success in ministry without numbers attached to it. And I looked at him and I said, I don't even know what that means. And he answered honestly. He said, yeah, me neither. But if we don't figure that out together, it sounds like it's going to destroy a good church and take a good pastor out of ministry. He said, I said, what do you mean by that? Redefine success in ministry without numbers attached to it. I said, it sounds to me like you're telling me to lower the bar, like I've been trying to jump over 10 feet, but I can only jump 8, so let's drop it to 8 and jump over that, and then we'll redefine success. That's not success, that's cheating. He said, that's not what I'm talking about. He said, Carl, the bar is over here. Success in ministry is over here. It's got nothing to do with the numbers that you've been chasing. We've got to figure out another way to look at it. We'll come back to my story in a little bit, but before I continue, I've been using the term small church, and small church is a relative term. Everybody's got their own definition. So I'm going to give you my working definition for this week, just so that you'll know when I talk what I'm referring to. So here's what I mean when I say small church. There are two very distinct types of small churches. There's the church of 50, give or take 50. And there's the church of 150, give or take 50. Those are two very different types of small churches. I know I've pastored both at length. They are very, very different. And if you're pastoring a church of 50, give or take, especially take, maybe you're pastoring a church of about 20 folks or so, which is really common, and you just heard me say 150 and maybe 50 more than that, you're thinking, he thinks 200 is a small church? That may be bigger than the biggest church in your town. I get it. I do. But here's why I define both of those as small, even given their differences. In a church of 50, give or take 50, the pastor can know everyone and be at every event. So the pastor's role is defined by their presence. In a church of 150, give or take, the pastor can be there for all of the major events and can know all of the regulars. And so still, the pastor's role is defined primarily by their presence. But most of the teaching that we receive about pastoring, especially after seminary, is from our big church friends, and they are our friends, and I've got no problem with big churches. We'll talk about that in a bit. But when we're only hearing from our big church friends, or primarily hearing from our big church friends, in the big church, the pastor's role is defined primarily by their absence, not their presence. So if someone's preaching to thousands of people on a Sunday, literally the only time most members ever see their pastor is on stage on a Sunday at a distance. And so they teach about how do we do this better? How do we delegate the pastoral role, the counseling role, the discipleship role? And that's what we're taught, how to do that. And we're seldom taught from a small church perspective how to do it where most of us are, which is pastoring by presence rather than pastoring in absence. Neither one of them is right or wrong. Each one of them has adaptations that have to be made. But that's why I consider both of those to be small. They are very different, the church of 50, give or take, and the 50 of 150, give or take. But that's where they have in common. So why did I end up in a counselor's office, leaving my church for 40 days, and almost ready to leave ministry? It's because I believe something that I have since come to call the grasshopper myth. The grasshopper myth is the title of my first book. So when you write a book with the title grasshopper myth, like Ricky used to say to Lucy, you got some splaining to do. All right, so what is the grasshopper myth? Here's how I define it. The grasshopper myth is the false impression that our small church ministry is less than what God says it is because we compare ourselves with others. What's the problem word in that sentence? Yeah, compare. Everybody knows it. Here's that we all know the comparison is the problem, and yet we all do it. But comparison is the death of healthy ministry. If you're comparing the size of your ministry with the size of anybody else's ministry, either you will be bigger than theirs and filled with pride, or you will be smaller than theirs and filled with shame, and neither pride nor shame is the basis for healthy ministry. But that's what we do. So why do I call it the grasshopper myth? Where does that name come from? Well, it comes from the book of Numbers. We know the story, right? The 12 spies go into the promised land. 10 of them come back with a negative report. And a part of that report includes these words. All the people we saw there are of great size. One translation said there are giants in the land. Then they said this, we seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes and we looked the same to them. Where did they seem like grasshoppers first? In their own eyes. I have good news for you. If you don't see a grasshopper in your mirror, no one else will see a grasshopper in you. It always starts with self-despising. Eleanor Roosevelt is credited with saying, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. But I gave that consent to all the giant churches around me who were not trying to make me feel inferior. They were just doing what God called them to do. But I was comparing myself to them. It always starts with self-despising. That's the Old Testament example. In the New Testament, it's the same thing. In the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, we know the body analogy, right? The Apostle Paul's body analogy. And in my head, the body analogy always began with the hand looking at the foot and going, oh, you're just a stupid, smelly foot. You don't belong in the body. That's not where it begins. Here's where it begins. 1 Corinthians 12:15 starts this way. Now, if the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body. It would not for that reason stop being a part of the body. New Testament and Old Testament, it starts with self-despising. This is good news. Because if my opinion of being small starts with what someone else puts upon me, I can't change them. But if it starts with me, I can change me. Yeah, I surrender it to Jesus and that can be changed. So, he told me we need to redefine success in ministry, so what do we do? So I started looking into that, I started asking myself about it, and some of the first things that I discovered were what I've since come to call three undeniable realities of church ministry. Let's take a look at these three one at a time. They're all important. First of all, reality number one, 80 to 90% of churches will never be larger than 250 people. How do I know this? because the best predictor of future events is past events. And for 2,000 years and counting, as Jesus has been relentlessly building his church, 80 to 90% of churches, probably even higher than that, have never gotten larger than 250 people. And yet somehow the church doesn't just survive, it thrives. The small church is the typical church. We've been led to believe that the mega church, the big church, is the standard, is the norm. It's not wrong, but it's not normal. So if your church is small, you're not broken, you're what we call normal, and there's no reason to fix normal. Now, you may have stuff in your church that needs fixing, but the size isn't the indication of that. The size is not a problem to fix. So that's the first thing. 80 to 90% of churches will never be larger than 250 people, which leads to reality number two. Virtually all pastors will pastor a small church for at least some time in our ministry. Really? All of us? Yep. But who's telling our Bible college students this? No one told me. So when it happened to me, I thought I was broken. They didn't even tell me it was likely, if not almost certain. Virtually all pastors are going to pastor a small church for at least some time in our ministry. A whole lot of us are going to pastor small churches for most of our ministry, and a bunch of us are going to pastor small churches for our entire time in ministry. So here's my question. If we're all going to do it, shouldn't we be figuring out how to do small well? But for 40 years, I've been going to pastor leadership conferences, and they've told me how not to be small anymore. They haven't told me how to do small well. See, I don't want churches to be small. I want small churches to be great. But we don't even know that's possible, given the language that we continue to hear from each other in church leadership circles most of the time. We're all going to do it, so let's figure out how to do it well, which leads to reality number three. You can lead a small church well without settling for less. I don't get much pushback on this ministry, even from my big church friends. I think part of the reason is because if they push back on this, it feels like they're beating up on the little guy, and no, but that's not a good look for anyone. But anytime I do get pushback, it's almost always on this point. It'll be something like, well, Carl, that's great that you're doing the small churches and you're helping them along, but we want to reach our community for Jesus, so we're going to keep getting bigger. To which I always respond, so you think your peers in small church ministry don't want to reach their communities for Jesus, and that's why they're small? And there's always the big, oh, no, that's not what I mean, that's not what I mean. Yeah, but that's what you just said. And trust me, it's not the first time we've all heard it. We hear it over and over again. Oh, you just don't care. Oh, you're settling for less. No, here's my question. What if all of these small churches all over the world aren't a problem to fix? What if they're a part of a strategy that God wants to use? You see, if we approach them as a problem, we'll be trying to fix things that may not need to be fixed. But if we approach them as a strategy, we'll approach them in a completely different way. Most of us have not been approaching small church ministry strategically. We've been approaching it problematically, and that's a problem. So that shift of mindset, how can we be strategically small, is often the first point of light bulb for a whole lot of small church pastors, and it was for me. But we don't get there very quickly or easily, and why is that? Well, one of the reasons is because of something that I like to call IKEA envy. How many of you in the room have never been in an IKEA in your life? Raise your hand. You've never been in an IKEA. You are the ones who are blessed and highly favored of the Lord, obviously. The rest of us are still laboring under some version of the curse. We've been to an IKEA. Yeah, it was 20 years ago or so, but the IKEA came into near us, and one day Shelly said, we got to go to this new furniture store called IKEA, and we got to get something. I don't know what it was. So we're driving there, and I've got a furniture store in my mind. And we turn the curve on the freeway, and there's IKEA, and I'm going, astronauts are looking at this from the International Space Station right now. They can see it. These are the biggest stores on the planet. But I thought, we've done big stores before, malls. I know how this is going to go. We'll walk in. She'll find what she needs to find. I'm going to wander around the store. I'll find something somewhere that doesn't bore me to tears. When she's ready, she'll text me. We'll meet at the exit, and then we'll go home. Oh, no, not in an IKEA. You're not allowed to wander around in an IKEA. Now, if you've never been in an IKEA, you may be wondering, what do you mean? How are you not allowed to wander around a store? Here's how. Oh, it didn't show up, did it? Oh, there we go. That's a typical floor plan of a typical IKEA right there. Every one of them looks just like that, right? You've been in it? You know. You see that dotted line? Does it seem like something that ought to have a piece of cheese at the end of it? Yeah, it's like a rat maze, right? By the time you get through with it, it takes so long, even their Swedish meatballs taste good. So why am I telling you this? Here's why. I want you to imagine that the chairman of Starbucks gets together with his top executives. And he says, I've got a plan for the growth of Starbucks for the next few years. We've gone around the world, we've measured all the IKEA stores, and they have an average of 200,000 square feet. We've gone around the world, and we've measured all the Starbucks stores, and our average Starbucks shop has about 800 square feet. We need to fix this if we're going to compete with IKEA. Does that make any sense at all? No, because Starbucks and IKEA have very, very different business plans. IKEA's business plan is just a few stores, but as big as we can make them. And Starbucks' plan seems to be as many stores as we can possibly put in every tiny little spot that we can find. Now, you might not like Starbucks, you might not like IKEA, that's fine. But you cannot argue that IKEA has been extraordinarily successful at what they set out to do, and Starbucks has been extraordinarily successful at what they set out to do, and they've gone in opposite directions. Completely different business plans. But why am I telling you this? Well, take a look at the screen. Look at the IKEA. What's on the floor of the IKEA? They literally have arrows on the floor. If they didn't have arrows on the floor, people would get lost. People have gotten lost in there for days. It's why they sell beds. You have to have an arrow on the floor. It's just too confusing otherwise. But I've never walked into a Starbucks and gone, where are the arrows? I don't know where to go. This is so confusing. Somebody please help me. It's pretty obvious what to do in a Starbucks. But here's the challenge. We often come to groups like this and we hear from our friends who are in the big IKEA-sized churches and they're giving us arrows on the floor precision ideas. We take them home to our Starbucks-sized churches and it doesn't fit. And we leave these conferences and we go, were they wrong or am I stupid? Because what they're saying works at their store. Church isn't working in my church. I've got good news for you. They're not wrong. You're not stupid. You're just in very, very different places. You don't need arrows on the floor in a Starbucks-sized church. So what they're saying isn't wrong from their perspective. We've got to realize that a small church is not a big church, only less. A small church and a big church, the difference isn't a matter of scale, it's a matter of type. Small and big churches are different types of churches. Tomorrow morning, we're going to get into some of the details on that, what those differences are and why they matter for everybody in every size of a church. Size dynamic matters because it helps us to pastor and lead better and understand strategically how Jesus wants us to work within the congregations that we serve. So we'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow. But the main thing for you to remember on that for tonight is it's not just a difference of scale, it's a difference of type. So as I'm going through this, I begin to realize some things about small churches. And one of the first things I realized, actually three of them, were this. Small is not a problem, a virtue, or an excuse. Let me walk you through those three very important words. First of all, small is not a problem. I say that up front because it's often been presented that way. How many times have we been told, you must be stuck, you must be broken? Why? Simply because you're small. But we're doing healthy ministry. We're actually reaching the community. We've got this really cool outreach going on here. Yeah, but you haven't gotten any bigger than that in the last couple of years. You're stuck. The presumption is that small is, by its nature, a problem. Small is not a problem. But it's been presented that way all over the place. I know this because back in that time when we were going through that crisis and I was trying to figure out what's wrong with our church, why aren't we getting bigger? I did what we all do when we're facing that kind of emotional and spiritual crisis. I Googled it. Why is my church so small? And this is way back at the beginning of the internet. There weren't that many things out there. So the first one that came up was an article entitled Eight Reasons Some Churches Don't Grow. And it was written by a pastor who was pastoring one of the largest, fastest growing, well-known churches in the country. So I thought, this guy knows the answer. I'm going to read this thing and I'm going to figure it out. And here are the eight reasons that were given. Eight reasons some churches don't grow. The vision is not clear. The focus is on trying to please everyone. Passionless leadership. Manufacturing energy. Lack of prayer, unwillingness to take risks, disobedience to scriptures, and selfish attitudes. And I looked at that list and I thought, I must be committing at least one of those sins. But I didn't think we were manufacturing energy. I thought I was praying enough. I didn't think we were trying to please everybody. I don't feel very selfish. If you just heard that list and you're in a small church and that list doesn't sound like you or your church, I give you full permission to stop reading those lists. In fact, I'm going to virtually guarantee that that list doesn't apply to you or to the church that you serve. And you know how I can pretty much guarantee that? Because you showed up this week. Prayerless pastors don't show up. Pastors who are unwilling to take risks don't show up. Disobedient pastors don't show up. It makes me wonder who this pastor thought he was writing to. Who does he think is on their computer at 2 a.m. going, please help my church grow? It's not the faithless pastor. It's not the disobedient pastor. It's not the prayerless pastor. It's a hurting pastor. And if a hurting pastor comes to you asking for help, don't slap their hands, put tools in them. Small is not a problem. We've got to stop treating it like it is. Secondly, small is not a virtue. Right? Big churches are great. I love big churches. They're awesome. They're fantastic. And I'm not saying that just to do the compliment sandwich. I enjoy big churches. I'm thrilled anytime I hear about the way God is moving in big churches. It's great. Anytime 3,000 people are getting together in one place to worship Jesus, how is that not anything but awesome? But it's also awesome when 3,000 people are worshiping Jesus in 30 different churches. The power of the Holy Spirit is not stronger because there are more of us in the room. Either one is fine. It's great. Small churches are not a problem, but small churches are not a virtue. Small is not better than big. I'm done. I've had it. I'm not going to listen anymore to the small church pastors who every once in a while I still hear it. We'll go, you know, the only reason our church is so small, we're the only church in our town preaching the true gospel. Okay, here's the deal. Unless your church is literally the only church in your town. The likelihood of that is so minimal, I'm not even going to give it the time. And let's have a conversation about your pride problem, because that's a bigger issue than the size of your church. It reminds me, remember that list that I read from the big pastor about small churches? I've heard every single one of those accusations lobbed from small churches about big churches. Those big churches, they're manufacturing energy. They're selfish. They're trying to please everyone. They're disobedient to scriptures. I've heard every one of them lobbed the other direction. This is so weird because animal behavioralists tell us. Yeah, this is going to be fun. That if you put monkeys in cages and they get mad at each other, do you know what the monkeys do? Yeah, they throw their poop at each other. I know you didn't expect to hear that word from the platform tonight, but there you go, monkeys. That wasn't the word that concerned you? Oh, okay. That's what they do, right? And when we do this in the body of Christ, we make the monkeys look good. That's the level that this is at. Oh, you big churches, you just compromised. Oh, you little churches, you're just settling for less. Stop it! Nonsense. We need everybody in this. There's reason for big churches. There's reasons for small churches that celebrate when they're healthy of any size. Small is not a problem. Small is not a virtue. And thirdly, small is not an excuse. No more. Well, you know, once we get bigger, then we'll be able to. No. I've read the entire New Testament. You'll be happy to know. More than once. I have yet to read through the New Testament, see a command to the church, and go, oh, we should, oh, we can't do that. We don't have enough people. Oh, Jesus says the church should, oh, we don't have that. We can't do that. We don't have enough money. Oh, look at this cool thing that Jesus said the church should be doing. Oh, we can't do that. You need a building for that. We don't have a building. There's not a single command to the church in the New Testament that your church right now cannot do right now. So no more excuses. Let's get to work. This is a no excuse zone. Small is not a problem. Small is not a virtue. And small is not an excuse to do anything less than excellent ministry right away. Now, excellent ministry looks different in a small church than in a big church in some significant ways, and we'll talk about that tomorrow morning, but it's not an excuse. So, I had this time. I walked away for those 40 days, and like I said earlier, I wish I could tell you that during those 40 days I spent it in prayer and fasting, but I didn't. I ate too much ice cream, and I watched too much stupid TV. And if you're going to watch stupid TV, you're going to watch reality TV. I know because I live where they make them. In fact, I'm married to a real housewife of Orange County. Emphasis on the real. So during that 40 days away, I'm watching too much TV. I am. And for some reason, the two reality shows that kind of caught my attention were the two reality makeover shows where British restaurateurs come into American restaurants and tell them what their restaurant is doing wrong, and somehow miraculously in 4 days they fix everything. First of all, what is it about us as Americans that we'll listen to the worst criticism as long as it comes with a British accent? It's always a British guy, and we're always like, oh, that's kind of cool. He just called you a cow. Yeah, but he did it with a British accent. Isn't that cool? No, it's never cool. In fact, didn't we fight like an entire war so we don't have to pay attention to people with British accents anymore? I guess somehow, I don't know. So anyway, I'm watching these shows. And it's reality TV, so it's not real. I get it. But I'm noticing some patterns. Every once in a while, they'll walk into a restaurant and go, I drove by the thing 3 times and couldn't find it. We got to get you a better sign. Or they'd walk in and go, oh, what is that smell? We got to clean this carpet. One thing they never did, they never walked into a failing restaurant, looked around, and said, you know what this restaurant's problem is? It's not big enough. Not once. Because even phony reality TV stars know something that the church has to figure out, and it's this. 3 words. You ready for them? Bigger fixes nothing. Bigger fixes nothing. We got this picture in our head that the reason our churches are so small is because we're not big enough, and if only we'd get bigger, everything would be fixed. But bigger fixes nothing. Let's put it up on the slide. Bigger fixes nothing. Right? Oh, if only we had more people, we'd have everything solved. The reason we got so many problems in my church is because we don't have enough people. And if we had more people, we'd have fewer problems. You think more people are going to bring fewer problems? Have you met people? There's never been a time in the history of the world where more people have equaled fewer problems. Ever. See, here's how it works. Imagine you've got a small and unhealthy church, and all you do is make it bigger. You now have a big, unhealthy church. And that's not better. That's worse. But if you take a small, unhealthy church and you make it healthy, even if it doesn't become bigger, because it doesn't always become bigger, healthy is always better. You can lose with bigger. You can never lose with healthier. And no, healthier does not inevitably lead to bigger. I call it now the myth of inevitability. There's too much evidence in to show that all healthy things grow, as in if your church is healthy, it will get bigger, simply isn't true. It doesn't pass the scientific viability test. That experiment has been tried over and over and over again, and it works in very few situations. Bigger fixes nothing. So what do we need to start to do? Here's some things to start thinking about. I discovered an economic phenomenon in some of my kind of general reading a few years ago, and it's called the long tail, the phenomenon of the long tail. I'll show you this graph on the screen. The long tail is how all the big tech companies run their businesses. So we'll look at this graph. From bottom to top is how popular an item is. So on Amazon, it might be books. On Instagram, it might be videos. Let's use YouTube as an example, okay? So bottom to top is how popular an individual video is. Left to right is how many videos there are, okay? So over on the left, that big spike, that tall one there, there's one video on YouTube that is the most viewed video of all time. There's only one YouTube video that's been watched over 10 billion times. And at this point, the last I checked, it's pushing 16 billion views. Only one. Anybody got a guess? It's Baby Shark. And if you don't know what it is, let me play it now for you. No, I'll ruin your week. I won't do that. Baby Shark is a thing that toddlers love and keep going again, 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 again. And it is so irritating. Almost 16, maybe over 16 billion views at this time. It's the only one over 10 billion. So everybody wants the viral video, but there's only one of those. And then it drops really quickly, and there are a couple dozen that have over a billion views. And then there are a few hundred that have over 100 million. But you'll notice on the screen there, it drops really, really fast, and then it goes really, really long into what they call the long, long, long tail, into the 100-view video, the 50-view video, the 20-view video. And you see the bottom right-hand corner, you see that little tip in the bottom right-hand corner there? That's your church's live stream that was watched by two people last Sunday. Welcome, you're among friends. Now, if this wasn't broken out as a two-dimensional scale, but was only a one-dimensional continuum, you'd see it feel, well, you know, everybody's got more than me, I'm just stuck over here. But it's two-dimensional, which means there's only one video on the right, but there are billions of two-view videos. YouTube has figured this out. You know what they've understood? There are as many eyeballs on the screen for videos in the long tail as there are eyeballs on the screen for videos in the big spike. They know the big spike doesn't survive without the long tail doesn't survive without the big spike. Everybody wants the viral video. YouTube is fine with billions of small videos because they get the same number of eyeballs on the screen for them. Now, let's just change the wording on this graph to church, because the church looks exactly this way. Let's take a look at it together, okay? So on the left, you've got the biggest churches in the world. Right now, there are two churches in the world that nobody's quite sure which one is the biggest. One in Nigeria, one in India. Both of them have over 500,000 people attending on Sunday. Yeah, but only two of them. Then it drops real quick, and you've got only about a dozen or so churches that have over 100,000. Then it drops, and you've got maybe 100 or two that have over 10,000. Then it drops again and drops again until you get to the 200-person church, the 100-person church, the 50-person church, the 20-person church, and so on. And what demographics have shown to be true is this. Of the 2 billion people in the world who attend church on a regular basis, 1 billion of them attend churches in the big spike, and 1 billion attend churches in the long tail. And the dividing point is the church of about 200. So 1 billion Christians worship and minister in churches under 200, and 1 billion Christians worship and minister in churches of over 200. So which half of the church are we going to go, oh, we don't need you? You big churches, you're just compromised. You small churches, you're just settling for less. YouTube's been around barely 20 years, and they figured out they need everybody. The church has been around for 2,000. Shouldn't we have figured it out before YouTube did? We need everybody in on this. But here's one of the challenges we face. Over 90% of the pastoral training material that is produced by churches in the big spike, and it only applies to other churches in the big spike. And that's why we need to pay more attention to the long tail. So I'm not talking so much about small churches because I think they're better than big churches. One, because that's where I've spent my time. And two, because we need more resources because we're not getting the amount that we need. Fully 90% of churches serving half of the world's Christians are in the long tail. And we're not getting they're not getting the appreciation they deserve, and we're not getting the resources that we need. So we have got to pay more attention and embrace the long tail. All right, just about to wrap this up and let you go. But let me give you an idea of what's coming and a couple of quick things before we do go. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to do a session that I call Big Churches, Small Churches, What's the Difference? And we're going to talk about some of the differences, what these differences are, why they matter, including a little section that I like to call, Why is my church so weird? I got news for you. Your church is weird. And the smaller it is, the weirder. We're going to talk about why that is, how to understand that, and how to lean into it rather than run away from it. Yeah. In fact, by the end of the session tomorrow morning, not only will you have some understanding of the differences between big and small churches, but you will have a filter through which you can run all of the future information that you receive about pastoral leadership. You can run it through a filter that will help you pull out the stuff that doesn't apply in your context and only keep the stuff that does. That's part of the hope for tomorrow, okay? So that's tomorrow morning. And then tomorrow evening is going to be Desizing the Church, which is based on the new book that I just put out less than a year ago. And we'll be talking about some of the history of the church growth movement. Where this book came from was, I've been doing this ministry for about 12 years. And for the first 8 or 9 years, Shelley and I have been at these conferences, and we've met so many pastors who, even after one session like this, come to us with tears in their eyes and say, for the first time, I've gone to a pastoral church conference and have felt left feeling better about my small church and not worse. Thank you for that. And they're in tears. And we drive away from conferences so often, and we've used the term, man, we feel like we're pulling bodies out of the river here. And a couple years ago, I asked myself, well, let's keep pulling bodies out of the river, but is there a way to go upstream and find out who's tossing the bodies in? What are the causes of this obsession with size that we have? Because if we can figure out the causes, maybe we can find some solutions. So that's what that talk is going to be about, desizing the church. And then we'll finish up on Wednesday morning. We're talking about healthy pastoring through emotional and spiritual trauma. We all deal with it both internally in our own lives and our own families. Plus, we're trying to help people go through trauma. And there are some really real biblical answers that we can find on that. So we'll be looking at that tomorrow. Come on up, guys. I'm going to be about 2 more minutes, but you can come up behind me. At the book table, Shelley will be there. We've got 5 books there. Those are the prices. You can get one there, or you can get a set of all 5 for $50. But before we go, one last point. I want to walk through something personal with you. The Lord has been using this ministry in some ways that we never expected, including in the last couple of years, some requests internationally to take this message about the value of small church and resources for small church around the world. And so this year we've had some invitation, and I want to walk you through it. We have a Asia and Europe missions trip this year where we're going to be doing small church leader workshops in different places. First of all, coming up in May, we're going to be in Indonesia from the 13th to the 19th of May doing a conference there. Right now, they are translating my first book, The Grasshopper Myth, into the Indonesian language, spoken by over 300 million people. And they will be printing up 1,000 books, and they will be giving them away to all the pastors who come to that conference. And we are helping them pay for that. So that's part of where our finances are needed. Then in October, we're going to be going to Malaysia on October 1st through the 10th. We're going to be going to 3 different regions, the 3 main regions of Malaysia, so that we can get as close as we can to these small towns and to these small churches, because they can't come much of a distance because they don't have the finances. And we're going to go and we're going to try to reach them and do ministry with them. And then later in October, we're going to be spending some time in Switzerland. We're going to do 2 conferences in Austria, 3 in Germany. And all of this is coming up. So all of this, as we put it together, is going to cost somewhere between $18,000 to $19,000 for us to put off. I'm just letting you know that, so that if you are in any way able to help us out with that, we would really appreciate it. There's a QR code up there that you can scan, or you can just come back and see us at the table. Also, if you do donate today or tomorrow or while we're together, if you donate $100 or more, we'll give you the 5 books for free, and we will take our cost for the books and fold it into that $100. So we won't even receive reimbursement for what the books cost us. That'll be our contribution to the trip. So for $100 for all 5, and you can, that will all go towards this. We need about $18,000, and so far we've raised just a little over 3. So we're on our way, and we would appreciate any help you can give us on that. But let's land this way. One of the things that I had to learn as I was beginning to discover that small churches can be strategic was this. Pastoring a big church is not a reward for faithfulness. Pastoring a small church is not a penalty for faithlessness. I say that because for years I thought that was true. And the language that I was hearing all around me kept enforcing that. Oh, that big church, they must be doing something right. God's blessing. Oh, that church, they haven't gotten any bigger. They must be doing something wrong. What's going on there? What's the problem? We got to figure out how to fix this. Big church has just simply been presented as proof of God's blessing, and small as proof of some kind of faithlessness. We're missing something. We're not honoring God in some way. So if that's not true, if big church is not a reward for faithfulness, and if small churches are not a penalty for faithlessness, what's really going on? Here's what's really going on. Each of them has value, and they're worth doing well. So that's what we'll be talking about. I want to take some burden off your shoulders this week. You're probably doing a better job than you think you are, small church pastor. And if you can just realize that the size of your church is not the problem, then that's one less thing for you to worry about, and we can start looking strategically at how to do small well. Let me give you one example of that as we close. A couple years ago, I was invited to go and speak at a conference in Newfoundland, Canada. And we were having lunch between sessions. And there was one pastor sitting across the table from us, and we asked him, so where do you do ministry? And he says, I minister in Nain, Labrador. Now, I'm from that part of the world originally. I was actually born in Newfoundland. But I had never heard of Nain, so I said, Nain, where is that? He says, it's the northernmost town on the coast of Labrador. Now, if you don't know, North America is a giant V. On the top of the west coast is Alaska. On the top of the east coast is Labrador. So Newfoundland is the island off the coast. Labrador is the land above that. So Nain, Labrador is about as north as people live. I said, tell me about Nain, Labrador. He said, well, Nain's an interesting place. He said, you can only get in or out by boat or by plane, and for 7 months of the year, you can't even do that because the city is frozen in. So if you're in, you're in. If you're out, you're out for 7 months out of the year. And he said, they had a series of pastors that only stayed 1 year at a time because as soon as the thaw happened, they were out and nobody went back. He said, it's a town of about 1,400, mainly people of the Inuit tribe. I said, so how long have you been there? And he said, we've been there for 14 years. So tell me about ministry in Nain. He said, well, we got there the first year and the freeze came, which we were warned about. But what we weren't warned about is in addition to being frozen down for 7 months, there are blizzards that come in and can lock us into our houses for days or even weeks at a time. And one big blizzard came through and everybody was locked in for about 8 or 10 days. When we dug ourselves out at the end of that, we had church and we noticed a couple of our folks missing, and then they were missing the next Sunday. So we went to visit them and we found a couple of our church members frozen to death in their homes. You see, the Inuit people have been a nomadic tribe for generations. And in their culture, you only own what you can carry on your back. And the older folks especially cannot adapt to the idea living in the city that you can own more than that. You can stock up firewood. You can't get them to understand that. So my wife and I realized the first job we got to do is save some lives. So every minute we had to spare, we went out and we cut down wood and we brought it home. And then when a blizzard was coming, we'd go to all the most vulnerable people that we knew and we'd give them enough firewood to last through the coming blizzard. And we just saved one life at a time. I said, wow, 14 years, how much longer are you staying? He said, I actually just resigned before I came and we're going to go back and they're going to have my farewell party because I'm 74 years old and I just had my fourth heart attack. So I thought, sir, you are dismissed with our thanks. I said, what's the hardest part of ministry in Nain? Is it the cold? He said, no. He said, the hardest part of ministry in Nain is being accepted by the Inuit. Because one pastor after another, and they haven't always been treated well by folks whose skin color looks like mine. And it took a few years before they finally accepted us. And then when we announced our departure, it was absolute sorrow. I mean, I've never seen people so upset and so sad in my life. He said, I actually went to my best friend, who's an Inuit man, who I led to the Lord years ago, and who's now a deacon board member. And I said, why is everybody so upset about us leaving? I get that they love us, but it seems like over the top. He said, Pastor, they love you. And he said, What did we do to get them to love us so much? And he said, Pastor, it's simple. You came, you stayed, you loved us. You came, you stayed, you loved us. For a decade or more, I've been looking for a good answer to the question, how do you redefine success in ministry? And I don't think I'll ever come up with a better redefinition of success in ministry than what was spoken by an Inuit man in Nain, Labrador. You came, you stayed, you loved us. And then he said, not only that, but he said, my wife and I haven't cut any firewood for the last decade because we taught our people to do that for each other. And so we can leave now and we know nobody will ever freeze to death in their homes in Nain, Labrador ever again because we were there. Success in ministry? Yeah. Is there a box that you can put a big number in for that that's going to impress anybody? Nope. He came. He stayed. He loved them. Thank you.